Hi, Marco Werman here. One of the things we pride ourselves on at The World is our approach to the news. The stories are often interconnected and complex, but we know you get it. Our key areas of focus, such as migration, climate change, public health, and global security, often have ripple effects. Because of the time and care we invest in our reporting, our correspondents are able to draw out these important connections for you. Take Carolyn Beeler's reporting that connected the war in Ukraine with European climate targets, or Halima Gakandi's reporting on the impact extreme drought in Somalia has on migration, or Joy Hackel's superb work as a producer, lining up people for me to speak with all across Ukraine. Listener support helps us connect you each day with the news. If you've already donated, thank you so much for investing in our work. If you haven't donated and you value the independent, nuanced journalism from The World, I hope you'll make a gift today. You can donate at theworld.org/give. Or follow the link in our episode notes. And if you're able, I hope you'll consider making a monthly donation to keep us going all year long. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give. Thanks. And now, the show.
Millions of people are returning to their homes in Ukraine. It's a challenge to restart their lives and their small businesses.
It's really hard to predict something when you don't understand where the rocket will be next.
Also ahead, Saudi Arabia's crown prince continues to meet international leaders, sweeping the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi even further under the rug.
There don't seem to be any international repercussions. After all, President Biden is going to visit Saudi Arabia in mid-July, and he'll also meet with the Saudi crown prince.
And the Sri Lankan prime minister warns the economy there could hit rock bottom.
One would argue that we are already at rock bottom.
I'm Carol Hills. Plus, Brits are fired up about their big summer concert. Now, if they could just figure out how to get there. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Thanks for joining us today. The sounds of rescuers in Afghanistan trying to reach people trapped under rubble. An earthquake early this morning shook eastern parts of the country. The Associated Press estimates that at least 1,000 people have been killed, but that number is hard to verify. Telecommunications are poor in the area, making a full accounting of the damage difficult to capture. The quake, estimated around 6.0, comes as Afghanistan is facing a host of challenges. Many international aid agencies left after the Taliban takeover 10 months ago, and the country has been disconnected from the international financial system because of U.S. sanctions, all of which will hamper efforts to provide help for the earthquake victims. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Local men rushed the wounded to a helicopter in an open field. In this video posted online, they're carrying the injured using blankets. This is the deadliest earthquake in Afghanistan in the past 2 decades, and it hit one of the most remote parts of the country with few emergency resources. Most of these homes were built with mud, which can't survive earthquakes of this magnitude. This disaster will be putting the new government in Kabul to test. Soheil Shaheen, Taliban's appointed representative to the UN, sent me this audio message a few hours after the earthquake hit.
Dead bodies are being recovered from the debris, increasing casualties by every minute.
Shaheen said more rescuers are trying to reach the area. In the meantime, people dug with their hands and shovels. They recovered bodies from under the rubble. One man reportedly lost 17 members of his family. Online videos showed rows of graves being dug to bury the dead. Lucien Christen is the spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Afghanistan. He says survivors need basic necessities.
Of course, you have people whose house have been destroyed, so they need shelter. They have lost their personal belongings, so they need clothes, they need cooking sets, they need water, they need food.
Christen says ICRC teams have been deployed to the area, but in general, the aid effort is slow because international NGOs left Afghanistan last year when the Taliban took power by force. The Taliban takeover stopped much of the fighting, he says, but dismantled public services.
Which meant for Afghanistan, the complete stop of projects that were supported affecting critical infrastructure such as hospitals, electricity network, water networks, etc.
Besides the sudden stop in some public services, Afghans have also been cut off from the international banking system. Afghanistan's money has been blocked in American and European banks. The Taliban government hasn't paid salaries to its employees, which means doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers have gone months without pay. Christian says some aid groups like his have helped compensate healthcare workers so that they can continue to provide services. But getting donations to Afghanistan is tricky. That's why some Afghans outside the country are stepping in to help. Sara Wahidi is the founder of a civic technology startup called Ehtesab. It was initially designed to alert people in cities so they can avoid roadblocks and bombings. But now she's using her platform to crowdsource donations for the earthquake victims.
So we are currently working with our journalists and others who work within our team who have contacts on the ground to create a small hub of contacts that we can quickly provide this information to.
Wahidi says this earthquake is just one of many disasters her country is facing today.
Not only are we dealing with incessant human rights violations, incessant instability, this humanitarian crisis, hunger, poverty, we're now dealing with the floods that have happened in the last few days and this earthquake.
As the sun set in Paktika and Khost provinces in eastern Afghanistan today, it started to rain. Videos showed people searching for their loved ones under the rain and in the darkness of the night. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The war in Ukraine has decimated that country's small businesses. By March, nearly half of them had closed. Now, 4 months into the conflict, millions of Ukrainians are returning home, including many entrepreneurs. Reporter Ashley Westerman has the story of one small shop in the capital, Kyiv, that has reopened its doors.
Hi. Finnick Family is a boutique coffee shop and dried goods store that sits on a sloping hill near Kyiv city center. The store's owner, Ilana Kucharian, welcomes us in with a big smile.
Maybe something cold drinks.
The small, brightly lit shop is lined with neatly designed packages of goods from Ukraine, Armenia, the Middle East, and as far as Hawaii. Dried pears, figs, and peaches, mixed seed bags, and their specialty, dates with fillings.
For example, Philadelphia and Orange Crunch.
Initially opened in 2020, the store was a dream for Kocharian and her husband.
Because it was for us a dream to open such a boutique in this sphere. Because earlier in Ukraine, dried fruits...
They were terrible,
yes.
Their dream came to an abrupt halt earlier this year when Russia invaded Ukraine and started shelling the capital. Kocharian and her family fled to Europe, and for 2 months they waited out the war in Austria.
But we wanted to come home and to open the shop and to continue our work. It's difficult, yes, but we have to work and we will work every day.
The shop reopened on May 30th, and they're just breaking even, Kocharian says. Compared to before the war, they're making 5 times less in store and 10 times less in online orders. There's also been some supply issues, and they've had to lower some prices. But she says they'll stay open.
That's why we decided that we will work, and we are ready for anything.
The International Organization on Migration's latest numbers show that some 4.5 million Ukrainians displaced by the war have returned home. IOM Communications Officer Varvara Zatlutenko explains some of the reasons why.
Some of them have exhausted all their resources. Also, if the security situation is much better, it also facilitates a return.
Still, more than a third of the returnees say they feel unsafe, and they're ready to move again if they have to, she says. This uncertainty is acutely felt by small business owners who like stability, says Oksana Myronko. She's with the European Business Association, a nonprofit based in Kyiv.
Money loves silence, and it's really hard to predict something when you don't understand what will be next in the country and where the rocket will be next.
Her group found that now only 17% of small businesses in Ukraine remain closed because of the war, compared to 42% in March. And with no end to the war in sight, financial sustainability for many of these businesses is deteriorating, she says. Only 5% of small businesses say they have enough money to stay open for at least a year. Finnick Family Store in Kiev is one of those businesses. Owner Ilana Kocharian says she will keep her shop open as long as she can. It's her livelihood, and she doesn't want to leave Kiev again.
I think that all will be good. All will be good, but not in 1 year, not in 2 years. It will be good in several years. But Ukraine is a good country.
She says she saw a social media post recently that used the Ukrainian flag as an analogy for displaced people. The flag is blue on top to represent the sky and yellow on the bottom to represent the wheat grown on the rich Ukrainian land.
The one part of Ukrainian are under the safe sky in Europe, in other countries, but they have no ground. And we are now here, me, my family, we have ground, we have our home, but we have not safe sky.
For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman in Kiev.
Landmines kill more than 7,000 people each year, many of them children. Every single Western country has banned them, except the United States. But now the Biden administration is telling the Pentagon it no longer has the right to use landmines around the world, with one major exception. The World's Patrick Wynn is following the story. Patrick, why is the White House adopting this anti-landmine policy now?
A couple reasons, Carol. Landmines are back in the news again because Russia is using them in Ukraine in devastating ways that are killing civilians, which does fly in the face of a UN treaty banning landmines that most of the world's countries have signed. So this is an opportunity for Biden to say, we're better than that. We're not going to use them outside very special circumstances. And it does sync up with this campaign promise he made back in 2020 when then-President Trump actually gave the Pentagon broader authority to use landmines in battle. So politically, for Biden, this puts more distance between him and the legacy of Donald Trump, more distance from Russia. And the White House is framing this in human rights terms, because, as you know, landmines don't just vanish when wars end. They stay in the ground and they can kill random civilians decades later.
Practically, what will this change? I mean, does the U.S. actively use landmines in conflicts now around the world?
No, they don't. And the U.S. hasn't really used landmines since the first Gulf War in 1991. Even now, the Pentagon would still like to have the option to use them. And that's why they pressured Trump to expand the U.S. military's ability to use landmines, because countries like China, Russia, Pakistan, they all have landmines and they don't make any promises that they're not going to use them. Note that the U.S., though, Carol, is not agreeing to sign that U.N. treaty completely banning landmines, which, again, most of the world has signed. And that's a big caveat in Biden's decision. They are saying we will still reserve the right to use landmines in one particular place, and that's on the Korean Peninsula against North Korea.
So why reserve the right to use landmines against North Korea?
It has to do with the DMZ between North and South Korea. The U.S. previously planted lots and lots and lots of mines there. It later handed those minefields over to South Korea. So South Korea owns them now. But if North Korea were to invade, obviously the U.S. would team up with South Korea and repel that invasion, or try to, and they would want the ability to replenish those mines, those minefields, to use those mines and basically operate alongside Korean forces. So it does appear that the Pentagon put its foot down here and said, okay, you can ban mines for the most part everywhere but the Korean Peninsula.
So this is to do with a bilateral relationship between the U.S. and South Korea and a long history of the U.S. defending South Korea. How many landmines does the U.S. have left in its inventory, and what will happen to them?
3 million landmines left in the U.S. stockpile. All of those will be destroyed except for those needed in the Korean Peninsula. And obviously, this also means, Carol, the U.S. won't produce any new ones, which they haven't done in decades anyway. But this is important because these weapons, once you put them out there, they can end up in unintended places. For example, Myanmar is one of the most heavily mined places on Earth. There have been cases of American mines killing people there. And how did they get there? Well, at some point decades ago, the U.S. gave landmines to Thailand's army, and some unscrupulous soldiers sold them on the black market to rebel groups, and they end up killing some poor farmer in a country that the makers of those landmines never intended. So there's many stories like this around the world of mines killing people that the manufacturers of those mines had no intention of killing, and that is why so many countries, including every NATO country, banned mines a long time ago. The U.S. is really playing catch-up here and, you know, still holding on to some of its landmines in the Korean Peninsula.
The World's Patrick Nguyen talking about a change in U.S. policy on landmines. Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks, Carol.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Canadian members of parliament are hitting the panic button, literally. Canada's government is issuing mobile duress alarms to lawmakers. They're being used because threats to elected officials and their families have escalated dramatically in recent months, especially since a raucous convoy of truckers occupied Ottawa in February and March. Liberal Member of Parliament Judith Grow initially hesitated to accept a panic button. Now she has one. We reached out to learn why. Member of Parliament Grow, what were your initial concerns about getting one of these alarms?
Well, I think we all seem to think, you know, we have a phone and we're always attached to something somewhere, and having to get a panic button was just another way of tying us down with more things. And I thought it wouldn't be necessary. We're very safe on the Hill. There's a lot like your capital. There's a lot of protective personnel on site. And even though we had this significant convoy problem, I was still feeling fairly safe until one of the individuals decided to follow me home. And in order to talk to me, and I kept stopping and trying to answer him, and I didn't want to agitate him. And then I would keep walking, thinking he would pull back, and he just kept walking until I got about three quarters of the way home. And I did not want to agitate him. And I was going to take my phone out and try to quietly call 911. So I just turned to him very abruptly and said, "Stop now, or I will have to do some action in order to get you to go away. So please go back to your post at the convoy and leave me alone." And at that time, he turned around, and it left me feeling very vulnerable, even though I like to think I'm not, but I'm no different than anyone else, man or woman.
When did this happen?
This happened at the time of the convoy, when we had the truckers' convoy here, earlier in the year. And, you know, there were a lot of people here trying to get messages out regarding the mandates and so on and so forth. So I guess this young man thought that, you know, he could speak to me, and he did. I listened to him for a minute or two and then said, "Well, you know, I'm sorry, I can't help you. We're not removing these mandate requirements at the moment."
And these were around COVID, the mandates.
Yes. And then I kept walking towards my residence. Many of us here in Ottawa live within walking distance of the Hill. And it certainly changed my mind on my thinking that I am just so 100% secure that I shouldn't be worrying so much.
Even Canada's public safety minister, Marco Mendicino, says he's received death threats via social media. What sort of threats are other lawmakers facing?
I think similar to what the lawmakers in the U.S., if there's, you know, the threats of, you know, they're going to shoot you, kill you, knife you, whatever it is. We have a bill on firearms before the legislature right now. And again, that angers some people. And so they strike out at their elected officials in whatever way they can. And social media, of course, is a very easy thing to be able to use to make threats to people in a variety of different ways.
And I understand Jagmeet Singh, the leader of a small progressive party, and he's a practicing Sikh, that he was actually harassed by angry protesters last month. What happened there?
He was out visiting one of his local candidates, and a crowd of very angry people circled around him, calling him names and very racist comments and so on. I mean, it was they got very close to being quite violent.
Are these threats being traced so authorities can find out who is behind them?
Some of them are. They certainly, every effort is made to find out who's behind any of them, because it's against the law to do any of what they're doing with some of their threats. But certainly whenever the opportunity is, they can get the information, they are pursued to ensure people know that you can't go around threatening people's lives no matter who they are. And politicians, just because you're a politician doesn't mean that you're game out there, that people can make accusations and threats against you. And I think for a very long time in both of our countries, we've all been pretty safe. And when people come here, they always remarked about how we walk so freely here on the Hill. And we did without any. I've been here for over 20 years. And I've never felt threatened and never felt the concern that I should have a protective device on me. And things have changed in the last year and a half. The, I don't know if it's the pandemic that did it, but people's attitudes, there's a lot of frustration out there. There's a lot of mental health problems today that weren't there a couple of years ago, or at least they weren't visible. Now there's a lot of angry people, frustrated people, with a lot of different things. And as an elected official, we seem to be the target in both of our countries for that kind of an expression to happen.
Are the Canadian lawmakers being targeted? Do they come from across the political spectrum?
Predominantly right now it's the Liberals that we're hearing about. But it wasn't very long ago that it was the leader of the official opposition. So, it goes back to, I think, expressing anger at whoever happens to be the target that they can reach or communicate with.
Are most of the threats taking place online, or both online and up close?
Both online and up close. But if the up close ones, if the enforcement people are around, they can deal with it. It's when the online stuff is there, and it is a lot of it, and some of it is coached in a certain way that is untrackable and very difficult to trace down who it is that's saying it. But certainly investigations are done as soon as it's passed on to the appropriate officials as to what's being said.
You know, the stereotype of Canadians is that you are all unwaveringly polite. How did Canada get to this point?
Well, unfortunately, Canada follows a lot of what happens in the U.S. They're our next-door neighbor, and undoubtedly what happens in the U.S. trickles over here. And I think it's some of your frustration of the people in the U.S. From their election issues to Trump. And the pandemic's had a big hit on a lot of people in a lot of different ways. And so their attitudes aren't necessarily as refreshing as they used to be. And the frustration, maybe a year from now this will all be gone, but certainly right now we all have to be much more aware of our surroundings, whether we're at public events or just walking home from our workplace.
Judy Sgro is a Liberal member of the Canadian Parliament. She's been speaking to us from Ottawa. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Carol.
Head over to theworld.org and connect with stories you might have missed on the air. From a Chinese video game that's reached the peak of global popularity to the long-standing water crisis in Chile, our reporters bring you stories from around the globe with compelling angles. Catch up with them on our website, theworld.org. Heavy rains are hammering West Africa. Part of Ghana's capital, Accra, can't handle all that water.
The whole place is flooded. Roads are shredded. So many buildings are actually submerged.
Climate change is a culprit, but the situation has been made worse by developers who've clogged up the city's wetlands. That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is visiting Turkey today, an attempt to normalize relations between the two countries. Ankara and Riyadh fell out after the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. Khashoggi was murdered by agents of the Saudi government in Istanbul. Stephen A. Cook follows the Turkey-Saudi relationship. He's a senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington.
Stephen, this isn't the first visit between MBS, the Crown Prince, and Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. They visited in Saudi Arabia in April. Do you think this is the more significant of the two visits?
Well, it certainly is a more elaborate visit. President Erdogan is hosting a state banquet for the Saudi Crown Prince, and I think it's the Turks are kind of pulling out the stops in order to court the Crown Prince. Of course, it's an extraordinary turnaround since President Erdogan led the international effort to heap criticism on Mohammed bin Salman after the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
It certainly is. What does Turkey get out of fully normalizing relations with Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, the Turkish economy is in pretty bad shape, and President Erdogan has been forced to make a number of foreign policy U-turns, particularly with countries in the Persian Gulf seeking finance and investment from those countries, hoping that this will spur Turkish economic growth, help refloat the Turkish lira ahead of presidential elections coming just about a year from now.
So what specifically does Turkey want from Saudi Arabia?
Well, they certainly want whatever investment and whatever selling off of state assets the Turks are willing to do. But most importantly, they're interested in a currency swap. This is something that the Turks have been going around the world seeking to swap their currency, which has lost more than half of its value over the course of the last couple of years, for deposits in the Saudi currency. The Turks have a currency swap agreement with the United Arab Emirates, with China, with Qatar, and it would be beneficial to them if they could enter into such an agreement with the Saudis. It also would signal to international markets a certain amount of confidence in the Turkish economy and President Erdogan's stewardship of the Turkish economy.
So does this visit by MBS to Turkey, does it basically say that the Khashoggi affair is now water under the bridge?
Even before President Erdogan went to Saudi Arabia, the issue of Jamal Khashoggi's brutal murder in Istanbul became water under the bridge when the Turkish authorities transferred the case against those suspected of killing Khashoggi to Saudi authorities, essentially burying it and ensuring that those responsible won't really be held responsible.
And so that's that. Are there any international repercussions for sweeping the Khashoggi case under the rug at this point?
There don't seem to be any international repercussions. After all, President Biden is going to visit Saudi Arabia in mid-July, and he'll also meet with the Saudi Crown Prince. So essentially, the memory of Jamal Khashoggi and the memory of his brutal murder will be kept alive by human rights activists, his friends, and others, but there's likely to be very little geopolitical accountability for the Crown Prince.
MBS has been on a tour of the region in the last week. He's been to Egypt, Jordan, and now Turkey. As you mentioned, he's also set to receive a visit from President Biden. Do you think this signals the end of his pariah status?
Undoubtedly, that's the case. He was never a pariah in the Arab world. Saudi Arabia is an important player, and as the heir to the throne and the keeper of the two holy places, Mecca and Medina, he was never a pariah. Even in the United States, his European partners have inched closer and closer to Mohammed bin Salman. Essentially, President Biden was the last holdout, and I think that his visit will absolutely bring an end to this episode where people sought to avoid being seen with the Saudis at the very least, but the rehabilitation of Mohammed bin Salman is well underway.
And that rehabilitation is because all these countries that are now kind of cozying up to him need what he has.
That's exactly the case. In the case of the United States, the president is doing everything he can to mitigate the pain that Americans are feeling at the gas pump right now. And Saudi Arabia is really the only country with the spare capacity who can produce oil cheaply enough to moderate prices in the relative short term.
A lot of the major players in the region, like Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Israel, Egypt, they seem to be resolving their issues at the moment in an effort to move things forward. What is happening here?
Yeah, it's been rather extraordinary. The Middle East, a year or so ago, people were wondering, you know, where the next war would come from and which conflict would produce the next actual shooting war. But countries have determined that they have been unable to impose their will on each other through proxy fights and trying to outmaneuver each other in Libya or Syria or Iraq, other places where there's actual fighting, and have determined that the best way to go about actually their regional competition is to reduce those tensions. In the case of Turkey and Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, for example, where there was very significant differences and actually a war of words among these governments, the Saudis and the Emiratis haven't exactly fallen in love with the Turks, but they see Turkish vulnerability in the deterioration of the Turkish economy and have sought to gain some leverage with the Turks that way instead of on the battlefields of Libya or Syria.
How should the Biden administration be viewing this meeting between MBS and Erdogan?
Well, I do think that the Biden administration is somewhat relieved that the president is not the only one who is letting bygones be bygones with Mohammed bin Salman. It is something that I think the administration welcomes. They certainly don't want to see lots of tension in the Middle East as the president focuses on the conflict in Ukraine. So less regional tension in the Middle East is better for the United States. At the level of politics and optics, again, the more people who rehabilitate Mohammed bin Salman before the president arrives in Saudi Arabia is probably better for the White House.
Stephen A. Cook is a senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. Thanks a lot, Stephen.
My pleasure.
If you compare greenhouse gas emissions by continent, it's clear that Africa is on the lower end of contributors. And yet the continent is suffering from some of the heaviest impacts of climate change, from famine to flooding. Parts of West Africa are now seeing unusually large amounts of rainfall. Consider the case of Ghana's capital, Accra. The city has been hit by a series of floods in May and June. Reporter Ridwan Karim Dini Osman went to Alajo, a suburb of Accra, where roads are shredded, buildings submerged, and the people there are trying to figure out what to do.
Enoch Amua, a resident here, says he woke up at about 2:30 a.m. to find almost everything in his room floating.
And it just come at once. We don't know where to pass. We did not take even anything.
Fearing for his life, he waded through the flood waters to get to a safe spot. He tells me this is the second incident in 3 days.
This one is very, very bad. It's not easy. Everything has spoiled. Everything has spoiled.
Amua is barefoot with only a towel tied around his waist. He says he doesn't know where to go next since he has no relatives in Accra. Nearby, I meet Isaac Asumening with his wife and 3 young children. Forced out of their home by the floods, they are now stranded. Asumeni says all attempts to catch a ride to the home of a family member in a nearby town have failed.
The road is full of flood. No car, no bicycle, no motor, nothing. You can't pass.
Accra has flooded about 4 times in less than 2 months this year.
I have no option until the government comes in. I have no option than to throw the things away. Mm.
Rapid urbanization, inadequate infrastructure, as well as growth of informal settlements are exposing more people to climate hazards. The devastating effects of floods linked to climate change is not only being felt in Ghana. In Nigeria, flooding has become an annual recurring phenomenon. It affects almost every part of the country and is becoming worse by the year. Pictures of homes and roads submerged in flood waters circulate on social media. In Ghana, as part of measures to stem future floods, Ghana's president, Nana Akufo-Addo, has directed local authorities to immediately demolish illegal homes built in or near streams and creeks that are impeding the flow of water.
You will be held accountable for any breaches that result in damage from flooding. As president of the republic, I will not allow the selfish acts of a few to jeopardize the collective futures of the rest of us.
But experts are worried this may not exactly address the problem.
So it's like you have a fever and you decide to put a cold towel on the person's forehead. It will cool the person down, but you haven't hit the underlying cause.
That's Professor Christopher Gordon, a founding director of the Institute for Environmental and Sanitation Studies at the University of Ghana. He says research conducted by the Institute reveals one of the root causes of Accra's worsening floods is the influx of property developers who have built commercial and residential properties over wetlands.
We've had encroachment of up to 40% of them. And we have remote sense imagery which shows the change from vegetated areas to bare and built-up areas. So it is a problem.
He explains that wetlands function as natural sponges that trap and slowly release rainwater, hence slowing the speed of flood waters and distributing them more slowly over the flood plain.
The worst case scenario is that practically half of Accra will be unlivable or will be damaged.
Gordon says efforts should be made to restore most of the depleted wetlands. Back at Alajo, residents continue to count their losses caused by the floods. It may take a while to rebuild, and more rains are expected till the end of June. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
After months of crisis, Sri Lanka's economy has now hit an all-time low. The country's prime minister told Parliament today that the economy has, quote, collapsed and could reach rock bottom. The island nation of 22 million people is now unable to purchase fuel, said Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe. Here to tell us more is Iswaran Ratnam. He's a reporter for the Sri Lankan newspaper The Daily Mirror and joins us from the capital, Colombo. Iswaran, what does a collapsed economy mean for the people of Sri Lanka in practical terms?
Well, it means they can't purchase the essential items. There is no fuel, as you said. And basically, their daily lives have been affected. I mean, right now, as we speak, schools in Colombo, as well as the rest of the island, have been closed because of the shortage of fuel. And public transport is very limited. The economy is having a serious impact on the daily lives of the ordinary people in Colombo and in other parts of the country.
Has it affected your own life, how you go about your daily life?
Yes, it has. I've been without fuel for the past week or so. So I've limited my outings because I need to depend on cabs to go. And there are very few cabs as well. Public transport in Sri Lanka is not up to mark. As a result, I've been mostly staying at home. I would go out on work-related coverages and stuff. And of course, even at home, the dependency on, like, say, if we have three meals a day, then, you know, a third meal is sometimes limited. That is not just me, but that is how even most people in Sri Lanka these days are surviving.
It's an incredible story because times have been tough for a number of months now. I'm wondering how people in Sri Lanka are reacting to this latest statement by the Prime Minister that the economy has basically collapsed.
Well, there has been very little reaction from the public so far, mainly because there have been some protests taking place in Colombo. These protests were going on even as the Prime Minister was making this statement. There was a protest outside his private residence, and there was a protest in another part of Colombo. So the focus of the public, the focus of the media, was also on these two protests. So there's been very little reaction from the public to his statement itself. Having said that, the Prime Minister has been basically saying the same story over the last couple of weeks as well. He has been saying that the situation is bad, that we are going to go from bad to worse, and that we are trying to work on a solution. At least the very little reaction that has come out is that, you know, what's new? He has said this before, he's saying it again, but the people are still suffering. We don't see an immediate solution.
Has the Prime Minister said anything about countries that might help them out or provide them with petroleum? I mean, it's a dire situation.
Well, the Prime Minister has mentioned in one of his earlier statements that Russia is considering or is willing to come forward and offer assistance. But there is a catch to that, and that is, of course, the fact that the U.S. has imposed sanctions on Russia. So we are wary of that as well. You know, dealing with Russia could hurt our relationship with the U.S., and the U.S. has also offered some sort of assistance at the moment. But right now, of course, we are working with the IMF, and the Prime Minister in his statement on Wednesday also mentioned that going to the IMF is probably the only solution we have right now, because as far as fuel is concerned, nobody's willing to offer us fuel. So he feels that the IMF is probably the only immediate solution that we can work on. And in fact, there is an IMF delegation currently in Sri Lanka discussing a proposal with the authorities.
The Prime Minister also said today that the situation could reach a possible fall to rock bottom. He said the economy had collapsed. What does rock bottom look like?
Well, one would argue that we are already at rock bottom because the situation is so bad. I mean, we don't have fuel. So one wonders what he means by rock bottom. But I think he's also emphasizing that if we don't continue to negotiate and try to reach an agreement with the IMF, then that would mean there is no other solution in sight. And why he's emphasizing on that point is because there is some opposition. There have been a few protests. Some of the opposition political parties in parliament have also been objecting. So he's trying to strike this point that if not for the IMF, then there's no other solution in sight. And that would mean that we are going to be in an even more serious situation.
Finally, I mean, when you walk out in the streets of Colombo, are people just going about their business or is there a sense of desperation? I mean, are people sort of walking around like wondering what to do?
Well, in Colombo, people are going about their normal lives. And I live in Colombo. So, I mean, you walk into a restaurant, it's still packed, despite the fact that we are facing a serious economic crisis. But the streets, the different image that you see on the streets today, as opposed to maybe 2 or 3 months ago, is when you get close to a fuel station. And that is where you see these long queues and people venting their frustration at the authorities. There's always a tense moment. So, you know, the frustration is coming out at fuel queues. People at home are suffering. But daily life on the street seems to be going on as normal, as possible at least.
We've been speaking to Esperon Ratnam, based in the Sri Lankan capital, Colombo. He's a reporter for the Sri Lankan newspaper, The Daily Mirror. Esperon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Western leaders announced some tough economic sanctions.
Today, I'm announcing the United States is targeting the main artery of Russia's economy. We're banning all imports of Russian oil and gas and energy.
That's President Biden in March. Last month, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen joined in.
Council should now be able to finalize a ban on almost 90% of all Russian oil imports by the end of the year.
Hit them where it hurts. But lots of other places buy Russian oil, India and China, for example, and they may actually be benefiting from Western sanctions on Russia. That's because Russia is offering a steep discount on its oil. The price of oil on world markets sells for more than $100 a barrel. Russian oil goes for about a third of that price. Derek Grossman is a senior defense analyst at the RAND Corporation. Derek, when India buys Russian oil on the cheap, how does this impact Western sanctions?
I think that India purchasing discounted Russian oil unfortunately undermines Western-led sanctions. And notice I say Western-led because, I mean, these sanctions were not agreed upon through the United Nations. It is mostly Western countries plus a few others around the world that are friendly with the United States who are participating, for example, Japan and South Korea, and Australia, and a few others. And India is not participating in the sanctions. And they've made it very clear that because it was not agreed upon in the United Nations, that it does not have validity for them to follow. And so by purchasing, you know, oil at these discounted prices, and I mean, you know, one estimate from the Wall Street Journal shows that, you know, they were purchasing about 30,000 barrels a month, and now they're up to 1 million barrels per month. The West, in particular the United States, is trying to punish Russia for continuing its war in Ukraine. And by Russia continuing to have an outlet to sell oil, whether it's India or China, they continue to get money in order to continue to keep the war going in Ukraine.
Does the discount they're offering, though, does that impact Russia, that they're just not getting as much money for the oil? Or is it they still getting a lot, even at that discounted rate?
They're certainly not getting as much as they would have during peacetime, but some money is better than no money. And so I think the U.S., you know, still has a legitimate gripe there because, you know, it does undermine the effectiveness of the sanctions.
Now, India is friendly with the U.S. and Russia. How does India walk this line diplomatically?
They have a longstanding relationship with Russia dating back to the Cold War, and there's a lot of historical baggage there vis-a-vis the U.S., and they depend on Russia for military assistance and also for energy, in other words, oil and also coal in particular. And so they're not willing to let that relationship go. But they've also, in the last few years, become extraordinarily close with the United States. In fact, I'd say the partnership is the best it's ever been. And a lot of that is due to a mutual interest in countering China and also the fact that both are democracies. And so India has walked a very fine line. And they are going to at the end of the day, try to maintain what they say is their strategic autonomy by pursuing a policy of non-alignment. In my view, it's an ultra-realist policy. It doesn't take into account, you know, maintaining the rules-based liberal international order. It doesn't take into account morality. It doesn't take into account a lot of those things we wish they would. But that is the path that they are going to pursue.
Overall, how much pressure can Europe and the U.S. put on Russia if other countries are ready to scoop up Russia's unsold oil?
Yeah, it's going to be hard. I mean, it's when you kind of look at it globally, out of, you know, 190 some odd countries, you only have really a very small percentage of those countries that are slapping Russia with sanctions. And even those that are in Europe, they're still consuming some Russian oil and natural gas. You know, it's going to be a long haul to try to bring Russia to its knees, as the Biden administration wants to do. And we really need, the United States really needs as many countries on board as possible. And India and China doing their thing is not really going to help us.
Derek Grossman is a senior defense analyst at the RAND Corporation. He's been telling us how India and China are blunting the impact of sanctions on Russia by increasing their purchases of Russian oil. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
After a three-year hiatus, Britain's largest music festival, Glastonbury, is back. It runs from today until Sunday. Music fans are thrilled, or chuffed, as they like to say across the pond. But there's been a slight hiccup in the fun. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
It's been three long years, but the Glastonbury gates are finally open. Think Woodstock, but with more mud. Glastonbury is on this huge farm in the southwest of England where people camp out and listen to music for 5 days. About 200,000 people are expected to show this year to watch headline acts like Billie Eilish, but when it comes with that, I want it. Kendrick Lamar, I got loyalty inside my DNA. And Paul McCartney. Emily Evis, who organizes the festival with her dad, spoke to the BBC this morning.
You know, it's been like this really, really like never-ending journey to actually get here.
But Evis says that's all behind her now.
It's just a miracle. Everybody's coming onto site. You can actually see from here that the fields that were green are now turning to kind of multicolored tents. By the end of the day, all of those will be full.
Some festival goers showed up bright and early to bag a prime spot to pitch their tents. They also spoke to the BBC.
So we got here at about 1:30 and queued literally since then, but it was all worth it.
Got here for about 5, slept on the ground for about an hour or so. That'll do.
Oh, for me it's unbelievable. You've got to try and make it if you can. It's hard work trying to get here, but yeah.
This year, it's been a little harder than usual.
There will be millions of tales of inconvenience this week when the biggest national rail strike in 30 years goes ahead, last-ditch talks collapsing in acrimony.
That's right. Britain is in the midst of the largest rail strike in a generation. Half the trains to the festival have been cancelled. The Great Western Railway Company is advising its customers that if they want to go to the festival, they need to plan ahead and travel as early as they can. Some people really took that advice to heart and showed up 2 days early. But in the end, it will all be worth it when Sir Paul takes the stage. Come on, everybody, don't keep me waiting. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Hi, this is Marco. Before I sign off, I want to remind you that The World is fundraising now through June 30th. Listeners like you support our work financially. Because of your help, our newsroom can focus our international reporting on people at the center of global events. Learn more and make your gift at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much.